You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Welcome to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters, and this week in partnership with WGSN. In these podcasts, we explore a huge range of crucial issues and exciting developments in the food industry with brilliant guests drawn from all areas of expertise. I'm Stephen Gates. I'm a TV presenter and writer, and I specialize in food and science. This podcast is part of our Future Gazing Trends series, and it's all about forecasting the future of food. Now, how does it work? How do you look at trends from a social and consumer angle? And how do you research market trends with data? How often do we get it right? How often and how do you go about it? Today, we're joined by Cara Nielsen, Director of WGSN Food and Drink.
Hello.
And Jennifer Creevy, Head of WGSN Food and Drink.
Hi there.
Now, let's talk about trend forecasting. First of all, though, can you tell us a little bit about WGSN?
Yes, this is Cara, and I'm calling in from California, so it's lovely to be here. WGSN is based in London, but is a global trend forecasting agency that got its start in the fashion business. And it was sharing insights for fashion designers by looking at what's going on out in the street and the catwalks, what designers were doing, and would share those ideas to inspire new design. And over the years, it has expanded to offer those kinds of trend inspirations and forecasts to inspire all kinds of product development, and now food and drink as well.
And what sort of clients do you work with?
We work with large companies, that manufacturers, as well as retailers, actually all kinds of companies. It's fascinating, you know, financial services, agencies, companies that make the kind of package that goes into the freezer case when you buy, you know, a frozen dinner, for example, for your meal. And like, who makes that package? Well, those are some of our clients, companies that are trying to understand what's going on with consumers around the world and that are looking for the kind of insights that we can share. So it's really a broad variety. We also have a lifestyle interior section. So of course, all the companies that look at furniture and materials and what are the next colors going to be. It's a really, really exciting place to be.
Okay, well, let's talk about the whole concept of trends. Now, I have a slight problem with the word. It sort of hints at, I don't know, shallowness, faddishness, or significance. But obviously, this is vitally important to people in the food industry. How do you see the concept of a trend?
So I am really glad you asked, because I want to be an advocate for trends. And I think trends have gotten a bad name lately, and they're being confused with fads. So if we think about a trend, trends, first of all, take a long time. They don't, you know, they're not just something that pop up at the beginning of summer, like the hot ice cream that you want to eat, or, you know, the new sort of hot drink, and then they're kind of burn out by the end. That would be a fad. But trends really are a reflection of what consumers, people need and want. They recognize that consumers have values, and those values are what drive our purchases. And our values are changing all the time. And as they change, what we are looking for in the marketplace changes. And that really describes like this trend movement, something that's growing over time. And I think right now we're all living in a perfect test case of living through a pandemic, where all of a sudden our situation, our lives have changed, and our values now are shifting and changing about what it is we need in our life, how we go about our business. And that's driving a lot of changes in the marketplace, which you'd call trends.
And what sort of trends used to be important, say, 5-10 years ago, that have significantly shifted and are no longer trends now?
Well, the thing about trends is they can last for a very long time. So if we think about functional food, for example, so did anybody have a cup of coffee or a cup of tea this morning to wake up?
That's really right now. Yeah.
Yeah, I figured. So that's the most simple. That's the simplest way of describing, like, we drink coffee because we like that caffeine, or tea, and we want to wake up in the morning. And so food and drink has been doing that for us for a very long time. And how that coffee, what the flavor is, what else you put in it, if it's a pumpkin spice latte, those things sort of are different reflections. But this functional element of it has never really changed. It's certainly something that has been part of our lives forever. So it's some of it's just in the details, but those core needs that we have of, hey, I need to wake up today and I'm going to drink some caffeine to do that, that remains the same. And that's what's so fascinating is trying to tease out what are those longer term elements and then what are the current reflections of that need state.
So now, for example, in coffee, what we've been talking about a lot this year is convenience. So the increasing amount of convenience that consumers need. And we just a couple of days ago put on our feed on our website a coffee concentrate, which essentially is like a version of a cordial. So you can make your cold brews at home just from a bottle of cordial. So the trends are changing, even though it's still coffee.
Gotcha. Okay. Now, is there what is the evolution? What's the genesis of a trend? I mean, does it start off with a series of fads of people tinkering with ideas and consumers getting excited about one particular thing, possibly from social media? And then does it transmutate into something a little bit more significant and at some point hit a tipping point at which you can say, right, this is a trend that you can make predictions on? Because what you're offering really is something significant enough that people will put substantial investment into something in response to your forecasting a trend.
That's right. And I think I will say that I don't think every fad turns into a trend, but I think fads are often a reflection of a deeper rooted trend. Mm-hmm. So let's think a little bit about, the plant-based food trend right now. Mm-hmm. Now, we've been talking about in the food industry, it's had a lot of different names over the years. You know, first it was just vegetarian meals, then it was flexitarian meals, and then when the word vegan wasn't so in vogue, it was, plant-based meals. Mm-hmm. And when we have to look at what's driving something. What are those drivers? And this is what businesses, and businesses, maybe an individual who wants to start a food truck or someone who wants to, who has created this really cool vegetarian or vegan thing at home because that's what they really believe in and they're not finding what they're looking for in the marketplace. So this isn't always big food companies, but anybody who has an idea of basically meeting an unmet need. And we see a lot of that, for example, with vegan consumers. It was fascinating a few years ago that a vegan chat group, somebody who's like an engineer during the day, but sort of a tinkerer at night, came up with this notion of aquafaba. Now, have you heard of aquafaba?
Oh, yeah. I had a little vegan phase. It makes an amazing mayonnaise.
Exactly. So here is chickpea cooking water, something that you might get if you buy a can of chickpeas and you pour off that water. The protein in the chickpea allows you to use that water to basically turn it into like egg whites. And that idea came from an individual, but it was meeting this unmet need of, hey, I'm a vegan, but I really want to have a cake with buttercream frosting, or I want to have a marshmallow or whatever it might be. And so the deeper rooted trend is plant-based eating for a variety of reasons, health, caring about animal welfare, caring about the planet. But there's the immediate need was, hey, I want to, have a marshmallow. And so people came up with this cool idea.
But now that's a really interesting one because marshmallows themselves have gone through a whole series of different changes. It started off as a sort of French luxury product using the plant called the marshmallow. It's a mallow that is, and the species is the marshmallow. And then it shifted through various different phases and it became a way for companies to print money by adding lots and lots of air to food. And I guess that's that. I mean, and it's a really important point that these things shift and the evolution of it has been become a technological marvel, the way that marshmallows are created now. So let's talk a little bit about how you actually go about all this stuff. It's all very good saying we're forecasting these trends. Is that, lots of people, can sit on TV sofas and forecast a trend, but how do you do it so people rely on your data and can make serious investment decisions? How do you go about it?
Well, that's a good question, and I'll start off, and then I'll have Jen chime in as well. But our company is it's a global company. We have experts in the field in various offices around the world that are tracking what's happening on the market level. But we also do in-depth studies using a certain kind of methodology that explores different parts of society. We look for market data, consumer research statistics. We look at what's happening from a government and policy standpoint. Right now, we're looking a lot at what's happening from a medical standpoint, as well as a regulatory standpoint, as far as it connects to the coronavirus. We also look at things that are just surging and taking over. Like, think about the rise of TikTok and internet influencers coming from that space. Mm. And then we put all this together and we look at how those are going to affect consumers, what are these new value sets, and then we make our predictions based on sort of a combination of observation and analysis so that we then project out using also our expertise as experts in our each different field to make these predictions up to, you know, 2 years out. We're also looking 5 years out and even up to 10 years out. And Jen's been involved with some of that work as well.
Yeah, I would just, thanks, Cara. I would just add to that, that Stefan, you mentioned earlier, sort of seeing trends from social media, but, you know, just to make clear, that's just one very small part of what we would look at, because often consumers don't even know what they're going to want in 2 years or 5 years or 10 years. So as Cara just outlined, there are lots of places that we would go to in our global team and monitoring that sort of throughout. So it could be technology, for example. So, you know, looking at the sort of cultured meat sector, for example, you know, you couldn't have imagined that a few years ago. And now there's a cultured meat company in Japan, which is advocating for consumers to try this at home, do DIY cultured meat at home. So there's a lot of those things that you know, definitely don't start on social. So just to add to that, so we would come up with, once we've done our sort of global look at society, technology, for example, we then look at what the consumer drivers are for 2 years ahead, and we would pocket all that together and come up with what we call our big ideas for the 2 years ahead. So I'll just give you an example to bring it to life, for example. So one for 2022 that we had was around selling survival. So essentially, this is the idea that brands can create products and services to offer reassurance and essentially enable self-reliance to combat what is definitely this year sort of growing uncertainty and fear. So in terms of food and drink, you know, we're seeing there's a huge amount of anxiety this year around health, of course, but also climate change. And both of those are sort of coming together to force these feelings on our consumers. And they just want food and drink brands to really empower them and help them sort of gain balance in this uncertain world. So we would go into those big ideas in much more detail. And then throughout the year, we would then always sort of, we call it like an invisible red line. We would always thread back to those big ideas throughout our reports and our content, so our customers can see what we're talking about now and how that's related to our big ideas and how that is related to what we're saying is really important for product development in 2 years' time.
And that, I mean, that it's a complex affair, isn't it? You're talking about psychology, you're talking about perception and analysis methods to be able to try and work that out. So on one level, I guess you got the data, which is, I mean, that's a task in its own right to get your data assembled. But then you've got to analyze it. And I presume that's where the human comes into the process. And you need to take that data and say, well, what can we overlay in terms of this? You know, is that about anxiety? Is it about an obsession with health? Is that in, you know, as a result of COVID-19? What, I mean, how do you go about that bit?
I mean, that's where the skill of the analyst comes in and the strategist, to be honest, because, you know, data will only ever give you part of the story. And to use a phrase that Cara always talks about, you know, data if something's a data point, then it's not a trend. It's not the first iteration of a trend, because once it's a data point, it won't be a trend. And it will have gone mainstream, for example. So that is where the skill of the analyst comes in. And, you know, coming back to WSN as a company, and the reason that we've got all these incredibly talented people in the company and covering different sectors means that we can pull from, say, the fashion sector, or we can pull from the lifestyle sector, and we can see the indicators and the signals throughout lots of different industries. And then we pull all that together. And personally for us, we then look at what that means for food and drink.
So a lot of this rests on how the consumer fits into your approach. But there are lots of different versions of a consumer, aren't they? How do you cope with that variability?
It's true that people, obviously, everybody has, everyone is an individual. They're making up their own decisions about what it is they want to eat and drink. But it goes back to what you said earlier, Stefan, about psychology. There are various theories that point out that there is a set of human values that it's global and it's human. And the values that we have, let's say around security, for example, this is a human value that everybody has to some degree or another. And so when we're talking about these consumer drivers, we're really going all the way back to core human values around safety, security, adventure, trying to get respect, trying to explore and be part of a community. So for example, right now, if we look back last year and we were talking about what we might be having for our holiday meal last year, we probably were feeling a little more adventurous and eager to try perhaps a new cuisine at the table, or to perhaps if we were feeling very comfortable economically, we'd be splurging out on some fancy champagne and other treats for our holiday table. Now, this year, things are really different. So this core, our values around what we need right now, it's being more secure and safe. And so we expect that for the holiday table this year, first of all, if you've been economically impacted by the pandemic, well, your spending is going to be a little bit different, but you're also going to take fewer risks. You might not buy some kind of exotic or different regional global cuisine flavor for your meal. You might be looking for those very traditional, very safe things that you're familiar with that maybe have been part of your family forever and that gives you security and makes you, you know, feel like part of a group. That's, you know, core psychology, that it really hasn't, it really would apply to all kinds of places. But there's also the part where a food brand would come in, or a retailer, or some of our clients, they know their clients and their target. So part of the strategy is how can they take what we're saying, but then apply it to the consumers or people or customers that they know best and find the insights that are going to match for them. So not everything we say would apply to every brand, but it's that finding the insight that really connects to their consumer or customer.
And in terms of how you present your findings and your understanding of trends, how does this work? Because presumably it works differently for different clients.
Well, how we present our forecasts. Our main sort of flagship forecasts for the year is in sort of report format, and that is for our subscribers. But you are correct. If a client comes to us and wants a specific set of research or data, and then we could do that bespoke.
And again, it's in the form of reports and broken down into sectors, or broken down into different types of consumers.
So I can give you the example of, we were just talking about the personas and our consumers. So how we would present that, for example, is once we've got our big ideas, we then thread that through into what we call our food and drink personas for 2 years ahead. So as Cara just said, we're not trying to replicate any client's particular customer profiling. What we're doing is we're gathering the sort of key consumer sentiments and profiles that are going to disrupt industries 2 years ahead. And we create five personas that businesses can then tap into for new product development. So they're each a set of values rather than specific demographic groups. So these mindsets are going to dominate new product development in 2 years ahead. So if I give you an example, it might bring it to life, which is one of our personas for this year is the techno-optimists.
Well, I like the sound of that. That's good.
This group very much views technology as the key to sort of unlocking an improved future. So for them, it sort of represents an unlimited capacity and its potential for change. So, you know, we've all lived through a very, very tough year. So they would really, really put their heart and soul into technology. And whether that's for, you know, the vision of the future in terms of being more sustainable, or a vision of the future which solves the pandemic for them, the vision of the future which solves the sort of health crisis that the pandemic's brought, they would put all their efforts into that. So therefore, for product developers, you know, you can easily see how to target that customer group, and you can then overlay that profile onto your own customer profiling.
And how do you know when a trend has reached the tipping point? Or I guess when a fad has reached the tipping point to become a trend that is important enough to tell a client about and thereby inform new product development?
Oh, that's a really good question. And that's something that is very important to our clients. They all want to know, well, how big is this trend? When is it going to get big enough for me to take advantage of it? Me meaning a brand or a company. One of the processes and methodologies that we use is something we call the trend curve, which sounds really fun, doesn't it? You kind of like go up the curve and go down the curve. So trends, like you're saying, you know, they start off very small. And when we're talking about food and drink trends, very often food and drink trends will come from the chef and culinary space. So you might have an individual chef or a group of chefs or creators that get excited about an ingredient or some kind of food. And then they start making it and they start selling it. And people then get excited about it. Right now, what we use for our methodology, we have a trend curve report. We have created our own custom influencer map. And this influencer map is made up of social media influencers that sit in four different phases or stages of like trend maturity. So for example, the innovators, which is the, you know, these are the innovators. These are the influencers that you might see on social media feed. They might be a chef. They might be a farmer. They could be a nutritionist, for example, that's really promoting some new immunity ingredient that is going to help us all, you know, never get COVID. So who would be making a quadrillion dollars if that really works?
Yeah, exactly.
But these influencers also are joined by, you know, we look at how the trend starts in this early stage and then moves into what we call early adopters and then early majority and finally mainstreamers. Now a trend, let's take the trend of that aquafaba, for example. So the aquafaba a few years ago basically popped up on social media from a vegan Facebook group. It was an individual who was playing around and created that aquafaba idea. So that would be an innovator trend. Well, then this person talks about it and other people hear it and it grows. Now, if the trend is meeting enough people's needs, it will be bigger. Those are the drivers that drive it basically through the trend curve. So what happened is Sir Kensington Mayonnaise, which was like an independent ingredient mayonnaise company that was making like artisan mayonnaise and ketchup, they actually started working and created a mayonnaise made with this aquafaba that they called Fabanaise. Now, this company was eventually purchased by Unilever, a very large multinational condiment company that obviously does all kinds of different, you know, consumer products. So now we see this little aquafaba that one person came up with move into a specialty food product, so an early adopter. And then a big company is looking lower there down the curve, looking for innovations that they may invest in. They did. They buy this company. They now can make Fabanaise on a much bigger scale than a little artisan company could. And then you now see Fabinet is moving into mainstream grocery stores around the world. Meanwhile, other mayonnaise brands are realizing there's a market for vegan mayonnaise. We better get on this. And of course, now there's a host of vegan mayonnaise. So this little trend of aquafaba now has been part and really influenced mainstream mayonnaise makers to offer vegan mayonnaise to everybody. But that takes some time. And, you know, these trends can start, they used to take like 10 years maybe to get to mainstream. Now they're going much faster, in part because of social media, the internet, the access to information, the buzziness of trends, and, you know, increased interest in food and what's happening in food.
So do you find yourselves looking at the waterfall of new products like watermelon seeds and all sorts of sort of strange twists on what we already have, and just racking your brains and thinking which is the one that's reached a tipping point? Or is it more a question of connecting a tree of different factors to say, okay, this has begun to have some real traction?
We do look at all those things, and it's exhausting. It's a big space, but it's also really exciting. And this comes from skill and expertise and strategy. We do. We have a feed that's part of our offering. We have our food and drink feed, which is the place where every day our strategists look around at the food news, at what they're seeing on restaurant menus, what they maybe saw at the farmer's market. And they put these little ideas in and we share them. And as these ideas start replicating, we start getting the indication like, hey, there's something going on here. But then we try to understand what those drivers are. And we make an expert opinion. If we know that this, you know, watermelon seed is going to resonate and has potential because of, let's say it's got a lot of protein, and let's say people just really love watermelon, we would try to understand like what could possibly drive watermelon seeds to become something that a bigger company should leverage, or that we even see growing, you know, more organically. And that's part of our expertise that we bring in. But it is based on, well, is there something there? Is there really a benefit? And, you know, The other thing to think about, are there enough watermelon seeds around to do anything with it? So there is often, you know, this whole supply issue, which definitely is over on the industry side. I don't think the everyday person worries so much about, are there enough watermelon seeds to make watermelon seed butter?
But you're absolutely right. For instance, if you're making avocado oil mayonnaise, there's only so much avocado oil on the planet.
Mm.
So how do you track new trends? What's the methodology behind it?
I'm not sure if I'd be repeating myself a little bit there, Stefan, in terms of the methodology as Cara explained it earlier, but it is really a case of our global team really looking for those really early signals as we've already laid out. And then our team would then really just track them, looking at how much investment is going into those companies, how many different types of companies there are, where are they in the globe, and, you know, is that a country which is investing in this type of particular ingredient or technology, and then also bringing that round full circle into the sort of consumer part of it. So is there a need for this? What's the consumer drivers? Are we looking 2 years ahead, or is it 5 years ahead, or is it even 10 years ahead? For example, eating insects is probably not this year, next year, or maybe even the year after, even though there are a certain amount of products out there. But if you look 10 years ahead, you know, we're going to need to eat insects, you know, for sustainable reasons. And, you know, the Western consumer will totally get over the fact that it's an insect, because it will just be buried in something, and they won't need to think about the fact that it's actually an insect, but we're not ready for it now. So it's pulling all those signals together and then just, you know, really keeping on top of it.
So let's get down to some specifics now. What are the trends that you see coming towards us for 2021?
Well, this too is, I love this when I think, I often go to, well, when I used to go to a cocktail parties or networking events, when we all used to be able to mingle, you know, I would tell people that I studied trends for a living. And of course, the next question was, as you can imagine, what's the next trend? And this is it's a fascinating question, because if I would tell them something they haven't heard of, they'd get really excited. But on the other hand, if I would tell them something that really was going to be trendy, it was big enough that they probably knew. And so they'd be a little disappointed. But so there's that part of the iterations of the trend. So I did try to go to a cocktail party with something in my back pocket that I could impress people with that they maybe didn't know about. So we actually, WGSN Food and Drink has released 8 key trends for 2021. But as you can imagine, we talk about all kinds of things in all kinds of categories. But a few of the topics that we think are going to be really exciting for next year include more delicious, really interesting vegan food. So we've talked about plant-based already. We've seen chefs, and this is really, you know, chefs are leading the way here, embracing a plant-based lifestyle and then using their skill to make just really very craveable comfort food, indulgent food. For example, we did a report on tacos recently, and one of the topics were vegan tacos being made by a female chef in Los Angeles who lives a vegan lifestyle and was making these really interesting vegan tacos using different kinds of obviously vegetables, beans, flavorings, chilies, but delivering a very craveable kind of indulgent, but also a taco that really fit into, you know, the Mexican heritage and Mexican cuisine. Mm. So that's one thing that we're excited about. The other one that I really want to talk about is my favorite, Crazy for Cacao.
There's been a bit of movement here recently, hasn't there?
Yes. My background is I was a pastry chef for many years and, of course, had to make something with chocolate every single day of my pastry chef career. And I also worked at a chocolate factory and learned a lot about cacao. So I have been waiting for more people to get excited about the cacao plant. And this year we're going to be seeing more food made from the pulp of the cacao pod.
Which now, is absolutely delicious, isn't it? And I mean, I know that people rarely get to it, but you know, it's covered in this white sort of very delicate, fragrant, so which doesn't really taste like chocolate, but has something extraordinary to it. And it's all just thrown away.
Exactly. It can be part of the process where the cacao beans, they sort of ferment, they're put out in the sun, that fruit, that pulp around them, around the actual bean part ferments, and it causes this magic transformation in the cacao bean, which makes it edible. But a lot of that pulp, exactly as you say, has been thrown out. So what's interesting about the driver behind some of this cacao fruit is an interest in being more resourceful and upcycling that former waste product and making something valuable about it. So that's one element. But as you said, it also tastes really good. So there's that driver as well. And it's interesting and it's a new discovery. So that's another driver. So you can see why what would be pushing someone, if I said, hey, would you like to try this cacao fruit soda? There could be all kinds of reasons why you'd be really interested in that. Mm.
It's a really interesting example as well, because cacao is one of those things that when it was first discovered, I mean, if you eat a little bit of chocolate nibs, it's unbelievably bitter. The flavors are not particularly complex, but there is something extraordinary in there. So it's had to go through so many different iterations of people fiddling with it and playing with it. And it became a fad at loads of different levels. But it still took hundreds of years for it to come to the stage where we get chocolate that we know and love. And now, as you say, it's got a new life to it. So these things are fascinating. And you know, things like chocolate have created fundamental changes to how the world works. So it's really, you know, these things aren't just throwaway trends. They can be, they can have a massive impact on the world. But what about bigger predictions? What is it possible to make a wild assumption? And it doesn't matter if you get it wrong at all, because it's a long way away. What are we going to be eating in 2030?
So I love these 10-year ahead forecasts, I have to say. So this is, I'm actually researching 2031 at the moment. So this is really exciting for me.
I'm a year behind then.
I'm already a year ahead. Yeah. So a couple of other things I'm really excited about. One is guilt-free foods, I'm calling them. Mm-hmm. So obviously, you know, we're the climate, you know, stability is key. Sustainability is really, really key. And the food production system just has to change. So I'm really excited about those startups and innovators that are trying to create products without using the traditional natural source. So, you know, just a couple of examples. There's a California-based startup called MeliBio, which is using microbiology to create honey without using bees. You know, they claim during a blind taste test that individuals were unable to distinguish it from the traditional product. I mean, who knows, but I do want to try it. You know, and a couple of others. One is Atomo, coffee company, creating coffee without the bean. And then interestingly, there are also companies trying to create some of the ingredients that we use all the time. So for example, there's a company called Biosciences looking at palm oil, which is obviously widely used in breads and snacks, for example, and basically created technology to brew a sustainable alternative to palm oil from microbes. And again, has just raised a further sort of £20 million investment earlier this year to do that. So I'm really excited about that. So it's not about never having honey from bees or never having coffee from beans, but it's about creating an alternative so that we can survive having both of these things. So I'm really excited about that. And then my second one I just wanted to pick out, which I mentioned earlier, which is around sort of growing foods in our own kitchens. So, you know, what might start with sort of hydroponics, you have a little hydroponic system in the corner of your kitchen, growing your lettuces or your herbs. And, you know, I strongly believe, well, we talked about one of our 2021 trends was labriculture, which is, you know, towards the end of next year, we'll see the first sort of cultured meat being sold. So by 2030, 2031, you know, we potentially will be growing this in our own kitchens, you know, in certain places in the world. And this is really exciting. And you know, basically DIY meat could be the new sourdough.
Yeah, I love the idea of that. I think some people might find it freaky, but I think that's absolutely fantastic and solves a lot of problems as well. Okay, so we're recording this in kind of mid-November. Any expectations about how trends will affect the holiday and Christmas table?
Yeah, obviously, none of us know what will happen this Christmas, whether we can celebrate with family and friends or not. But already we're seeing brands and retailers thinking ahead in terms of their ranges. So we're seeing smaller pack sizes to reflect smaller groups, an increase in plant-based. So some of the ranges that we've seen coming out are really elevating the traditional meal. So For several years, you know, the vegan alternative has been, you know, not up to scratch to the traditional turkey here. But now we're seeing amazing centerpieces that really go with all the traditional sides, and that, you know, would look center stage very much so as a turkey.
The simple nut roast is no longer enough.
No, it's definitely not enough. Definitely not enough. And then we're seeing affordable luxuries, because it's Christmas. People do want to treat themselves and they do want to celebrate. But of course, we're coming into a really difficult economic time. So people don't want to slash out too much, but they want the small, affordable luxuries. So brands are creating some of those without the sort of hefty price tags. And then I think the other one I would just pull out is, you know, there's a return to nostalgia, which, you know, we saw at the start of the pandemic, people were turning to some of the old school favorites. And we'll see that again this Christmas. It's like that feeling of comfort that we want at Christmas. So I think some of the nostalgic, the Ferrero Rochers will make a return to the table, that sort of thing.
I love the sound of that. Why the heck not?
Well, I was curious, of the things that we talked about, what trend do you think resonates most with you? And what do you think, what kind of trend do you think? So we've talked about, you know, fads versus trends, and trends having a little more sticking and staying power. Is there any kind of trend that you've adopted or new behavior you've adopted that tapped into those kinds of trends?
Well, what I'm fascinated by is, I guess it's a type of flexitarianism, but I often choose the vegan option in pubs and restaurants now, whenever I can get to them, if lockdown allows me. But I don't do it necessarily for any particular moral reason. You know, I've got a whole set of principles that I live by, but often it's just about this sense of I want to play. We have obviously in the UK fish and chips, with battered fish is a hugely important national dish. Now I've started to see a lot more things like deep fried battered jackfruit and things like that, and it can be absolutely amazing. And in a sense, I feel in the past I felt, well, I shouldn't really go for the vegan or vegetarian option because that's basically skipping around the concept of being an omnivore and sort of throwing restrictions around it. I now see this as the all of the things that are available these days are really exciting. I saw, we're getting things like banana flour salad and things like that, and it can be absolutely fantastic. So there's now a part of me which is, although I love the vegan aspect of things, it's actually about the adventure. It's about trying ingredients I never would have had access to before, but the vegan and plant-based market has suddenly allowed me to play, and that I find really exciting. Whether that's a trend that extends to everyone else or not, I don't know, but for me I find it so exciting.
That's interesting. Well, you can eat vegan for so many different reasons. Mm. You know, I'm the same as you. I would quite often go for it now, but more for environmental reasons than anything else. Yeah. But also, like you say, it's super exciting. And the range of choice is amazing now. So, yeah, it is about trying something new as well.
Yeah. I mean, obviously we're heartless, aren't we? Because we don't care about that. But no, we care about animal welfare as well. But once you can go beyond that and it gets more complex and you're literally talking about adventure and trying new things and finding new things to add to our own culinary repertoire as well, I think it gets really exciting.
Mm. Okay. Well, I think you've made a perfect closing point is that there's a hierarchy of trends and choices that we all play with in our head. And someday you may pick that, jackfruit, fish and chips, because you're in an adventurous mood. And another day you might get it for a different reason. And that's exactly a great way of sort of ending like how we think about trends. There's sometimes a hierarchy at play. Sometimes you're driven by one reason, and other times of the day or in your life, you're driven by another reason. And that's totally just how it works.
And that's how trends evolve. Well, I love that. You've been listening to the Tabletop Podcast brought to you by Food Matters, and this week in partnership with WGSN. You heard from Cara Nielsen, Jennifer Creevy, and me, Stephen Gates. Thank you very much. If you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry, from salmon farm sustainability to apprenticeships. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at Food Matters. .co.uk. Goodbye. You've been listening to the Tabletop Podcast brought to you by Food Matters. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, please visit foodmatters.co.uk.